For decades, we've debated what makes a great city. Is it the architecture that makes Chicago stand out? Is it museums and restaurants that make New York a more dynamic city than, say, Atlanta or Dallas? Or is it our 24-hour, easy-to-navigate subway system? Why are people flocking back to cities from the suburbs? Vitold Rybczynski weighs in on those and other urban issues in his latest book, Makeshift Metropolis, Ideas About Cities, which is published by Scribner. Mr. Rybczynski is the Meyerson Professor of Urbanism at the University of Pennsylvania and writes on architecture and urbanism for publications like the New York Times, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and Slate. Among his previous books is Home and A Clearing in the Distance, a biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, which was awarded the J. Anthony Lucas Prize. I'm very pleased to welcome Vitold Rybczynski back to our show. Hello.
Pleasure to be here.
Has the current recession been having an impact on architecture as both a profession and as an ideal?
Oh, very much so. The architects get the news first because when business is bad, you just pick up the phone and call your architect and say, stop. So unless a building is actually out of the ground, a lot of projects have fallen by the wayside.
On the other hand, there was a building boom during the Great Depression.
There was a building boom of institutions primarily because Yale, Penn, Harvard all built a lot of buildings because building was cheaper, construction was cheaper.
But where are all the great public works projects that were part of President Obama's vision for our economic recovery then?
Well, they're either being planned. They're certainly not being built. We're not replaying the Great Depression in that sense.
Can you talk about some of the main ideas behind the development of American cities in the early 20th century?
Well, the first part of the 20th century was really an age of planning. It started with the City Beautiful movement and the great works of architecture, the railway stations and the Penn stations and the libraries and city halls.
And then in the 50s, we started knocking those things down.
Well, the war and the Depression sort of was like an interlude. And the modernism came along and American architects and planners, and I think American people as well, felt that we needed to turn a new page, which had pretty disastrous effects in terms of urban renewal, public housing, urban expressways, all ideas that I think we've really realized were really bad ideas.
Although we did get a couple of beautiful buildings out of it, like the Seagram Building, but those seem to be the exceptions to the rule.
Yes, there were always great architects, and it was a period of building. Just as in New York, even the first decade of the 21st century was a period of international building. But in terms of the city, the second half of the century, we moved away from planning, and in a sense, the developers became the big planners of the cities.
Although recently we've seen some of the most famous architects in the world building in New York. In the past, they were least likely to have projects here. Is that just because city policies have changed?
I think it was the glamorization of architects. I was making a list a few days ago of all the Pritzker Prize winners who've built in New York. Almost all of them in the last 10 years have built at least one building here. Some of them have built several. So I think it was rather the boom years, the glamorization of architecture, and developers, because these are commercial buildings, saw architecture as something they could sell to people that was exciting and that would attract people.
Is that mostly in New York, or are we seeing that in other major cities as well?
Oh, no, that's an international phenomenon. So architects are globetrotters now, and successful architects build all over the world.
So people like Jean Nouvel are just spread thin at this moment.
Yes, some of them have very large practices. Some of them, Jean Nouvel, of course, went bankrupt because he spread himself too thin. He's back now, of course. But it has changed the nature of architectural practice.
Jane Jacobs was extremely influential as a writer, critic, and thinker. And she was very New York-centric in her idea of what a city should be. What made New York vibrant for her?
Well, she was from Scranton, Pennsylvania, and you could imagine a young woman coming to New York and just falling in love with the place. It had all the attributes, I think, that she discovered and made us rediscover about cities, the crowds on the street, the importance of density, of having lots of people and all of that it brought with it. And her great gift, I think, was that she reminded us of all this. And in not a small way, she was, I think, very instrumental in changing our ideas about planning and realizing that cities were organic things that had their own sort of rules.
And then there were some other people. Was it Theodore White?
Holly White was very important. I talk about Nat Glaser, who was
William. That's William.
Who
White,
was Jane Jacobs's editor and an influential thinker himself.
What's piecemeal urbanism?
I think piecemeal urbanism is something that comes from Jane Jacobs, and it's the idea that the city grows in little bits, not in huge chunks, but that we add a sort of layer to it. And that we don't do away with the old, we simply expand it.
And then she moved to Toronto.
That had more to do with the Vietnam War than with New York City.
Yeah, I mean, she won all those battles, and then she left.
But her influence, of course, through her writing remained. And she's undoubtedly, even though she's not an architect, she's not a planner, she's undoubtedly the most influential voice in city planning of the second half of the century.
Well, so how much change has there been in cities over the last quarter century?
Enormous changes. We've become much more urban as a nation, not only in the city, but of course in the metropolitan area. The cities, contrary, I think, to what Jane Jacobs hoped for and expected, did not become the only type of urbanization. The suburbs were much more important than she ever gave them credit for. And also new kinds of cities. She has a little bit to say about Los Angeles, and it's not very complimentary in her book. But Los Angeles became a great American city, truly one of the great cities. And so the shape of the city has changed. There are Houstons and LAs as well as New Yorks and Bostons.
Although in many instances we're seeing people moving back into the cities after decades of suburban flight.
They are moving back, but you know they're moving to small cities. The great growth in urban living is not in New York and L.A. It's in much smaller cities. So Americans are discovering cities, but as often happens, it's a kind of surprising discovery, and they like smaller places. They're more comfortable. You get to know more people, and so we've got a great boom of these small cities growing and attracting people.
And why are they attracted to them? Because they have certain priorities that aren't satisfied by a larger city like New York or Los Angeles?
Well, one of the things I talk about in the book is that an urban characteristic today, in a strange way, is the outdoors. People like cities where they can go skiing in half an hour or mountain climbing or sit on the beach, which of course helps LA. But those were not urban attributes 100 years ago. New York was a place because it was urban. It was hard and architectural and dense. Whereas today, a city is a place where you can go to the outdoors nearby. So that helps, especially Western and Northwestern cities, which tend to be in beautiful settings.
City planning is so often in response to what's happened earlier. Do you have any examples of urban planning that's gone terribly awry in the past two decades, or examples of what we've done right in American cities?
I think one of the terrible mistakes was public housing. I think the idea of concentrating people, poor people, is not a good idea. And I think we've also realized that putting them in tall buildings in most parts of the country has not worked at all. Consequently, we're demolishing public housing and replacing it with new forms of housing, which include a mixture of poor people and rich people, a mixture of market housing and public housing. And it tends to be lower, dense, but not high buildings, not 30-story buildings. So that certainly was a bad idea. A good
that
idea.
Was that old idea came out of Le Corbusier. Has he been kind of completely ignored nowadays?
As a planner.
He used to be the god.
Not as an architect,
when I went
he has
to
a great position. He was an extremely creative architect. As a planner, he's somebody who's, I think, lost enormous standing. There are some architects who would still like to bring back some of his ideas, but I certainly hope they're not successful because his ideas were pretty devastating to cities.
My guest is Witold Rybczynski, whose latest book is Makeshift Metropolis, Ideas About Cities. It is published by Scribner's. Hasn't the beautification of Chicago come at a price? Some argue that it might have been there might have been more good done if the money had been spent on policies affecting the city's poorest residents. But visitors to Chicago all are just enthralled.
Well, one of the great successes in cities in the last 30 years has been the sort of rejuvenation of downtown. And so mayors have tended to focus on that. Very few cities have had across-the-board rejuvenation. And so the jobs that were lost after the Second World War have not come back to cities. And the poor parts of cities, even wealthy cities, are still poor. So that remains still, I think, an unsolved problem. What we have learned how to attract people to cities, particularly visitors. And tourism is actually the biggest urban industry today, including in New York, but in every American city and internationally. We don't make shoes in cities anymore, but we manufacture entertainment and fun.
The yards in Washington, D.C. show how combining residential and commercial shopping and recreation are a good model for future cities. But that involves changing our whole concept about zoning laws, doesn't it?
Yes. The most successful projects today have tended to be places where, in this case, it was a Navy yard, and sometimes it's a railroad area, or it might be an abandoned port, where we change the zoning, but nobody gets displaced. It doesn't really change the city. Changing zoning is a very difficult thing, and that's why densifying, for instance, the suburbs is going to be a real challenge, because many of these laws are sort of cast in stone.
Well, in New York, zoning laws seem to have allowed an awful lot of manufacturing areas to become residential areas. We've seen that all along the Brooklyn waterfront, for example, now in Long Island City. And there was that whole matter of the Atlantic Yards project in downtown Brooklyn. What are your thoughts on that?
I thought the Atlantic Yards was an example of how the developers, in a sense, are taking the lead in being planners. I thought there were two problems there. One was the density seemed awfully high. And putting it in the hands of one architect, in this case Frank Gehry, I don't think is a good idea. I think I have great respect for him as an architect, but I don't think one architect should design blocks and blocks of a city. He should, again, it's going back to that piecemeal idea.
The Municipal Arts Society was opposed to it because it kind of cut Brooklyn down the middle, and they felt that a good idea, better planning, allows for streets going through and for more of a mixing of neighborhoods. Another issue with Atlantic Yards was the building of a sports arena. Earlier, we had a big debate here over whether to build a Jet stadium on the west side, and this is something that has become controversial all over the country. Do those stadiums actually wind up helping the community or costing the community an awful lot?
When they're planned, they're often described as economic sort of engines, and the evidence I've read is that they don't, in fact, contribute economically to a city. They're part of a city because it's part of the culture of a city to have sports. But I think their proponents tend to exaggerate the kind of economic spin-offs that come from them. And especially if they are subsidized by public funds, they really don't make a lot of sense.
What do you think about the growing number of bike paths in New York? It's led to an awful lot of anger among drivers and small business owners.
It's very easy to create a bike path because you just need a can of paint, basically. So it's attractive to politicians. But as you said, it's a cultural change. It requires a shift because drivers have to be more careful. Bicyclists have to be more respectful of pedestrians and drivers. And so I think in many cities, the painting those lanes in comes too quickly and the cultural shift hasn't happened yet.
Have you looked at what's happened with the little parks and resting areas in the middle of places like Times Square and Herald Square?
I think they're a real puzzle to me. because they seem very popular, whether it's the density of New York that makes it popular. But I think the rest of the country sees New York as sitting on deck chairs in the middle of the street and wonders what's going on.
And then there is also the fact that it has added to traffic congestion in those areas. Because, maybe that's a good thing that we are keeping cars out of the center of the town.
That's certainly a theory that one should make driving more difficult to keep cars out of parts of the city. And I think generally cities are heading in that direction.
You say we can learn something from the Israeli city, Modi'in. What can we learn from it?
Well, Modi'in is a new city halfway between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And I gave it in the book as an example of how a city, which is not particularly high, most of the buildings are walk-ups, six stories, but it's very dense. It's also an interesting city because I think, unlike people 100 years ago, we expect a lot of nature in our cities. We're looking to do things outdoors. That's why parks have become sort of more popular than ever. And Modi'in is a very green city. So the garden city, which was a sort of turn-of-the-century idea, I think may come back in new forms as we find ways to build dense cities but also green cities.
And we are building more cities in New York probably in response to that demand. We're building more parks all over the place.
Parks, definitely. Almost every large American city has some park construction going on.
Vital Rubshinsky will be giving a talk on Thursday, January 13th at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum on Orchard Street. That's at 6:30. You do need to RSVP. To find out how, go to our show page at WNYC.org. His latest book is Makeshift Metropolis, Ideas About Cities. It is published by Scribner's. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard.